Good morning. Good morning. I know some of you have been in and out, so just to catch you up, if you're jumping in this morning with us, we've been going through the Old Testament and seeing how the New Testament writers looked back on the Old Testament and saw Christ, and then how they talk about him in the New Testament. And we've been having a little bit of fun up till now, but you're here at this message, and we're going to try to do some serious work. We're going to be in the Gospel of Matthew, and we're going to be looking at a genealogy. Woohoo! And we're going to be seeing what this genealogy teaches us about Jesus, and what it teaches us about how the people of Jesus' time were looking for his coming. So, about 2 years ago, me and my wife bought our first house. Can everyone hear me? I know we had some echo problems before. I just want to make sure I can slow down if necessary, but I think we're okay. Okay. We bought our first house. It's about 100 years old, and it needs some work, but we decided that we would go ahead and go for it. And as we were getting ready to buy this house, my wife pitched me the idea of remodeling the bathroom. We started talking about it. The bathroom really did need it. It was about 100 years old, so it had weird toilets and things in there. And I had worked construction for several years, so I kind of knew what was involved. I knew about ripping things out. Putting them back together is a little more difficult. And she drew me pictures. She cast me a vision of what we could do. And so we moved into the house, and within 2 days, I woke up one morning and ripped out the bathroom. The problem was, neither of us had actually strategized how to finish the task. We didn't make a budget, we didn't make a plan, we just ripped the thing out. And so we spent the next 18 months without a shower or a bath in our house. We have two kids, so it was a little complicated, but we improvised a bit in ways I won't tell you. But after 18 months, sometime in that period of time, my wife got pregnant. And it became one of these issues where if you don't finish the bathroom before I have this baby, we're gonna have some real issues. So we started working really hard on getting the bathroom done, and to the extent where my wife was 7 months pregnant, tiling the bathroom floor while I was at work, which was just shameful to me as a guy. So she was on her hands and knees tiling the bathroom. And finally, right before the baby was born, we finished the bathroom extremely over budget and way past any reasonable deadline. And the reason was, we had a vision of what we wanted the bathroom to look like, but we had no strategy. We had an idea of where we wanted to go, but we almost failed to ever have a new bathroom because we didn't have a plan. So we're gonna be in Matthew chapter 1 today, and what I wanna show you is that Matthew presents us a vision in this genealogy of who he thinks Jesus will be and what he thinks Jesus will do. And then at the end of the book, he provides us a strategy for how that's going to be accomplished. So Matthew chapter 1, we're going to look at verse 1 and verse 17. I'm going to go ahead and read the first verse. This is the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Abraham. Okay, now go to verse 17. So all the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations. From David to deportation, or the word exile, to Babylon, 14 generations. And from deportation to Babylon to Christ, 14 generations. Now, if you read the middle part of this genealogy, you would find a typical genealogy with lists of names that are really hard to pronounce. But there's some particular details at the beginning and end of this genealogy that actually begin to show us exactly what Matthew is trying to do. So, the first detail is this. That first phrase, the book of the genealogy of Jesus, if I was to translate that for you literally, it would go something like this. The book of the Genesis of Jesus, the Messiah. That is a direct quote, word from word, from Genesis chapter 5, verse 1, where God has created Adam, Adam has fallen, and now we're going to have the book of the Genesis of Adam. And what you find as you read that genealogy is that every person in Adam's line has kids, and then they die. And they have kids, and then they die. And the point of Adam's genealogy is to show us that through Adam, death spread to all men. If Adam hadn't done what he had done in Genesis chapter 3, that genealogy would read very differently. We wouldn't have this phrase, "and then they died." And so what Matthew is doing for us at the very beginning of his gospel is setting up, in Jesus, we have a new trajectory of what a genealogy will look like. Where before we had Adam and death spreading through him, Jesus and his line will work a bit differently. And we're not exactly sure what that's going to look like yet, but he's going to go ahead and tell us in a little bit. So that's the first detail, is that Matthew takes us all the way back to the beginning to say Jesus is the start of something new. The second detail is the one that's a little more significant. And if you were here last night, we talked about this a little bit last night, that twice in this genealogy, at the beginning of it and the end, Jesus is connected as the son of Abraham and the son of David, the Messiah. So why does he do that? Why is Matthew picking these particular men to tie Jesus to? Well, we know that in Genesis, Adam fell. And if you remember when Adam fell, God made a promise to him that you will have a seed. We translate that usually as son. You'll have a son. And when this son comes, he's going to reverse all the evil that you just brought into the world. He's going to crush the enemy and he's going to change things. But when you read through Adam's genealogy, as we just discussed, how do the sons of Adam do? Do any of them come along and turn this thing around? No, actually, when you read the first 11 chapters of Genesis, things go from really bad to much worse to much worse. You have the flood, where God destroys all of mankind because they've gotten so wicked. You have the Tower of Babel, where God has to come and intervene because of the pride and arrogance of humans. The story of Genesis and Adam's sons is really, really bad. Until chapter 12. And in chapter 12 of Genesis, a new person steps on the scene named Abraham. And when Abraham steps on the scene, God begins to bless Abraham in ways that are directly opposite to the way he cursed Adam. So let me tell you what I'm talking about. Adam was kicked out of the land of blessing because of his sin. Abraham is called into a land of blessing. Adam and Eve were cursed in their ability to have children and bear and multiply. Abraham is promised children as much as the sea sand on the seashore. Adam had his dominion and authority and his greatness stripped away in his sin. But Abraham is promised that from him, kings will arise and nations. And where Adam and his descendants only brought curse and death everywhere they went, Abraham has promised that in him and in his seed, all the nations of the world would be blessed. And from all appearances, if we're reading the story of Genesis, Abraham is the son of Adam that we've been waiting for. He's the one that's going to turn around this whole story of what went wrong with mankind. But Abraham himself is promised that it's actually going to be one of his kids that bring this about. And so we start reading in the Old Testament, we follow the story of Abraham and his descendants. Because apparently his descendants are going to turn around the story of what's wrong with our world. And how does the story of Abraham's descendants go? It gets from bad to worse. As a matter of fact, the descendants of Abraham, we call them Israel, they end up, by the end of their story, as bad, if not worse, than the rest of the nations, to the extent where they are sacrificing. Knowing God, having a temple, they've put idols in the temple of God, and they're sacrificing their own children to idols. Abraham's descendants are not a blessing. They're a curse. So this question arises, well, where is this seed? Where is this son who's supposed to come along and change everything? And this guy comes along in the story of Abraham's descendants named David. And David is a man after God's own heart. And actually what David does is he begins to lead Abraham's descendants into blessing. The things that God had promised would happen for Abraham's people begin to happen. And it looks like David might be the one. But God comes to him in 2 Samuel 7 and says, "David, you're not the one. But I will give you a seed, a son." Every time God promises, Adam, Abraham and David, he promises him a seed, a son that would come along and change things. And in this case, David is promised a son who would rule the nations. God would give him an inheritance and would establish his throne, and he would rule the world in righteousness and justice and peace. David's son would be the one who would bring the blessing of Abraham to all the nations. And so we begin to read the story of David's descendants, the kings of Israel. How does their story go? From bad to worse. As a matter of fact, the kings in David's line lead the people into their idolatry and sacrificing their children. And the Old Testament prophets begin to pick up on the idea that this isn't happening. All these promises that God has given us, they're not coming about. And so begin to look forward to one person who would be born. One person who'd be in the line of David, who'd be an Israelite, who would not only turn around all the things that are happening in Israel, but when he turned around Israel, he would turn around all of humanity. This one they called the Messiah. That he would change the trajectory of humanity's story just by being born. And so when Matthew steps on the scene in the opening chapter, in the opening verses, and says, Jesus is the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham, in the line of Adam, he is declaring that Jesus is the one that all of history and all of the world has been waiting for. That when he comes, the things that he's going to do in his life and the things he's going to do for Israel will literally change the history of the world. It will have global impacts that touch every part of our world in every possible way. And so this genealogy, far from being boring, for Matthew is the most exciting moment in history, because the one that we've been waiting for has been born. He will reach the nations. And so what Matthew does at the beginning is take us all the way back to Genesis chapter 3, or Genesis chapter 5, the beginning of the story, and he walks us through in the genealogy, the story of the Old Testament, and presents Jesus as the climax, the heartbeat of everything that's been happening. And so here's the thing. Jesus arrives, and Matthew sets us up with this vision of this person who's going to touch the nations. But when you read Matthew, Jesus never leaves Israel. He actually barely steps outside of Israel. Jesus actually says things in his ministry like, I'm only here to reach Israel. And so this question arises, we've been set up for a person who's going to change the face of the planet, but he never leaves this tiny, tiny country in the middle of nowhere on the Mediterranean Sea. This vision hasn't come about. See, I think all of us would agree, we understand that Jesus loves the world, that Jesus has a heart to reach the nations. But I think at some level, we have failed to understand how he's trying to do that. And because we've failed to understand Jesus' strategy of reaching the nations, we end up like my bathroom project. Except for we're 2,000 years later, and we still haven't seen the vision of who Jesus was supposed to be carried out. And we've failed because we failed to understand his strategy. Matthew has opened his book in a certain way, presenting Jesus as a certain kind of person. He ends his book in a certain way to show you how that vision of who Jesus will be has been fulfilled. So turn to Matthew chapter 28. Jesus has these last words to his disciples. And these last words connect us all the way back to the opening chapter of Matthew because of the way Jesus talks about himself. So let's go ahead and read Matthew chapter 28. These verses are probably very familiar to you. We call it the Great Commission. Jesus came up and spoke to his disciples. This is verse 18, saying, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. That statement, all authority has been given to me, that's Jesus claiming to be the son of David who has come to rule the nations. All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all I've commanded you. And lo, I am with you always even to the ends of the earth. See, in this statement, the first thing Jesus says is, I have been given authority over the nations. And so what I would expect him to do at this point is start taking over. Right? If I had given you authority over all the nations as king, I would expect you to start exercising some authority. That's what we expect to happen. But instead, Jesus leaves and gives this task to his disciples, this strategy of spreading his rule to the nations that he calls making disciples. Now, every time I've read the Gospel of Matthew and I've gotten to these verses, I always think that is very anticlimactic. I've been given this vision of this Messiah who changes the face of the planet, and Jesus comes along and he leaves and says, go make disciples. That doesn't make sense to me. It never had. I don't understand where that's coming from. And what it forces me to do is stop for a second and say, Jesus has just presented his last words on earth to these disciples, and he says, make disciples. I need to go back and read through the Gospel of Matthew with this idea in mind of, what does he mean by make disciples? How did he do it, and why does he make this the most important thing? It's a good question. And here's what happens when you go back through Matthew. When you go back to the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus had thousands of followers. The word disciple means follower. He had thousands of them. He literally had a train, a crowd of people that kind of flowed with him everywhere he went, mostly because he provided food for free. Often he provided miracles, but they would travel with him. But even within these thousands of people, he had 70 specific disciples that he would send out on missions. But then he had these 12. These 12 disciples that literally lived with him. Everywhere Jesus went, they went. Everything Jesus did, they did. He trains them to do things he trains no one else to do. He teaches them things that he doesn't teach to anyone else. If you're reading through Matthew, for the first half of Matthew, Jesus is having this public ministry where he's teaching the crowds, and he's doing public miracles. And then halfway through the gospel, everything stops. And he turns to his disciples and says, who do you say I am? And that's where Peter stands up and says, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. And from that moment on, it tells us that Jesus began to teach his disciples specific things. And for the rest of the gospel, you can find out that he is teaching specifically his disciples things he didn't teach to the crowds. He's focused on them. We learn that discipleship here means that Jesus gave specific information and instructions and gave them understanding that no one else had. And lastly, the thing Jesus does is he sends his disciples out to do things that he can't do. There are villages and towns that Jesus can't reach as a single human. And so he empowers his disciples with the ability to cast out demons and to perform miracles and the power to preach. And he sends them out to do in these villages what Jesus was doing in his own villages to places he couldn't go. He was expanding his ministry through them. These weren't just any followers that followed along. They were hand-picked, intimate friends that lived closely with Jesus and understood him in ways no one else did. And so when Jesus gets to the end of his time on earth, his end of his ministry, and he's about to leave, he turns to his disciples, his 12. And he says, I want you to do among the nations what we just did for 3 years in Israel. I want you to travel from city to city and town to town across the world, and I want you to repeat what we just did for 3 years everywhere we go. The strategy was simple. Travel to a town, proclaim the gospel, and when there's interested people who respond, I want you to sit down and stay there as long as you can and pour into them my teaching, my instruction, and my love. I want you to live among them so that they can imitate you the way you imitate me. Teach them to live the way I live. And then when you're done with those people, you send them out to go do it again. Here's what's most interesting about this strategy. We've got to take a moment to understand this. This is a strategy of multiplying, not a strategy of addition. Okay, so if you know anything about business, which I most know nothing about, there's one thing to add a person one at a time to your group. But it's another thing to equip people to add more people who equip other people. That's a strategy of multiplication. And what it does is it exponentially allows things to grow at a rate that is almost uncontrollable. So let me tell you what I mean by this. This is probably the most important thing we walk away with today. There are 7.6 billion people in our world today. 7.6 billion people. More people than have ever existed before on this planet together exist now. Now, if I took two of you, if I convinced two of us in this room that we should make disciples, and we got together at the end of this conference, we sat down and said, Jesus called us to this strategy of making disciples. We are committing for 1 year, we're each going to find one person, and we're going to pour into them our love, our wisdom, how we understand Christ, how we understand Scripture. We're going to invite them into our life and let them see how we live, let them see our marriages, our kids, all the stuff we try to hide from most people. We're going to invite them in and say, I want you to imitate me as far as I imitate Christ. And for a year, we pour into them. And all this time that we're pouring into them, we're implanting to them this idea, what I'm doing for you, you need to turn around and do someone else. Do for someone else. We do that for a year. We get to the end of that year, and now there's six of us, six disciples, and we gather together at the end of the year and we say, hey, Jesus gave us this model and strategy of proclaiming and stretching his rule across the world. So each of us, we're going to commit this year, all six of us are going to find one person, and we're going to pour into them our love, our heart. We're going to invite them into our life. Let them see our marriages, our relationships. I'm going to teach them to walk like Christ the best I can. And I'm going to teach them that they need to do this for someone else. We get to the end of that year, and we now have, how many? 12 people. At the end of that year, all 12 of us say, we're going to do this again. We find 12 disciples. We do it for a year. We implant all along that you need to do this for someone else. How long do you think it would take if death rate stopped and birth rate continued, especially in a group like this where a lot of you have like 8 kids, if birth rate continued, how long do you think it would take to reach 7.6 billion people? 33 years. If everyone in this room picked up the mantle to do this, it would take 28 years. See, what Jesus was doing was leaving them a strategy of reaching the world with his reign in one lifetime. They could have accomplished it in one lifetime. Which brings up some very fascinating questions about how we think about discipleship. We often think about discipleship as a method of raising up new leadership and passing on the torch to the next generation, right? That's how we think of discipleship. But here, in this context, Jesus isn't giving them a strategy for raising up new leadership to pass the torch on. He's giving them a strategy to be the last generation to ever have to carry the torch because you accomplish the task. Discipleship is Jesus' strategy of spreading the gospel far and wide exponentially. And Paul in the early church, Paul got this hands down. He understood the strategy was to get this done within one lifetime. They weren't playing this long game of how do we make the church last for 2 millennia. No, Paul understood and expected Jesus to return at any moment, and so he had this ambition. He fervently pursued every avenue trying to reach the edges of the known world with the gospel of Jesus. And he embraced this idea of discipleship. He understood that his job was to do in Ephesus and Galatia and Rome what Jesus had just done in Israel. He was running around the entire known world, discipling other people to turn around and do what he just did. So in Acts, we see Paul doing what Jesus did. In Acts, Paul enters a city, proclaims the gospel, someone becomes interested, he plants himself and lives among them as long as he can until someone threatens to kill him, and then he moves on. Right? But he lives there, and he calls people to imitate him. Look at Philippians 3. It says, brethren, join in following my example and observe those who walk according to the pattern you have in me. Paul's whole strategy was to get people to imitate his lifestyle the way he imitated Christ's. That's why in Acts, if you reread Acts again, you'll find that the Christians in Acts are called disciples. The word shows up over and over and over again. And like Jesus, Paul didn't do this alone. We get this impression often that Paul was a lone ranger running around. But if you read closely, both in his letters and in Acts, everywhere Paul went, he had an entourage of people with him. He was rarely by himself. And what Paul does is exactly what Jesus does. When Paul has to go somewhere, but he can't make it, he sends Timothy and Epaphroditus in his place, saying, "There's no one else who has the same heart and mind as me, like Timothy and Epaphroditus. I'm sending them to you because they represent my pattern of living among you." Paul had disciples that he trained to be him, to be just like him, that he could reach the churches that he couldn't reach. And all Paul is doing is following the example and command of Jesus. See, this is not just sitting down and having coffee with someone once a week and telling them your life experiences and your wisdom. That's not discipleship. This is inviting someone into your life in a way that is uncomfortable and kind of breaks down that privacy barrier that we hold pretty tight. And letting them see how you apply or don't apply the gospel to every aspect of your life so that they can learn what it means to walk like Christ. This is the kind of discipleship that Jesus did, the kind of discipleship that Paul did, and what we are called to. Not just giving information or declaring a message, but living out the gospel in ways in your own private life that others can see. And what that means is, in this context, evangelism is just the beginning step of Jesus' strategy for reaching the world. It's just the first step of evangelism. But evangelism is not the strategy for reaching the world. The strategy is not proclaim the truth and then run away, because if they get saved, you don't know what to do with them. The strategy is proclaim the truth, and when someone is even interested, invite them in. Usually when we talk about discipleship, we separate it from evangelism. We evangelize, and then maybe if they come and get saved, then we'll disciple them. But that's not what discipleship is here. Discipleship encompasses evangelism. Why do I say that? Well, here's why. Because when we read the Gospel of Matthew carefully, Jesus called his disciples when they didn't yet believe in him. Because they were interested, he called them into relationship. He said, "Come and see." Additionally, Jesus doesn't say, "Stay where you're at in your hometown and make disciples." We don't see the disciples hanging out with each other, having coffee, and talking about these interesting things they found out about the Bible. No, he said, "Go to the nations who haven't heard, and there make disciples." The assumption of discipleship is evangelism is the first step. That's why baptism is involved. And so what the Gospel of Matthew has done is presented us with a vision of a Messiah that reaches the nations, and now he's giving us a strategy of how the Messiah wants to do it. He wants to do it through us. It's our job to carry on the messianic mission of the Messiah. And I think somewhere along the way, we've lost sight of that strategy. We're willing to call people to gospel-centered truth. Here's the truth, come hear it. But we're not calling people to gospel-centered relationship that teaches them who Christ is. This isn't just about learning the gospel and the specific truths and then telling someone else. It's about living it out in a way that trains others and invites them into a new kind of life. That's why it talks about picking up your cross and following Jesus, because this lifestyle requires sacrifice. Lots of it. But when we do this, literally, we could exponentially expand Jesus' kingdom in ways that we have never even imagined. If all of us in this room took one person and then took the next person and began discipling anyone in our context and showing them how to take that to the next person. Usually discipleship stops when I disciple this person and they gain all kinds of things from it, but I haven't told them, your job is to do this for someone else. And discipleship stops right there. And the strategy ends because we failed to keep in mind that I need to tell this person to pass it on. See, Jesus wants to take faithful, available, teachable followers who can hear his spirit and are willing to obey his spirit, who are willing to open up their hearts and their lives and pour out their love on other people. He wants to take them and stretch his mission across the world. I said at the beginning there's three details about this genealogy that are interesting. I have one last detail for you as I close. Usually when we find these genealogies in the Old Testament, especially in Genesis, you have the patriarch and all his descendants, right? That's how it works. Here's Adam, here's all his kids. Here's Abraham, here's all his kids. But with Jesus, we're introduced, here's Jesus, and then we're told all his ancestors. And the question arises, if you're a normal reader of the Bible, wait, where are Jesus' children? If he's the Messiah, it's the Messiah and his people that are supposed to change the world. Where are Jesus' kids? Well, when you read through Matthew, Jesus keeps talking about his true family. When his mother and brothers come to get him because they think he's crazy, he turns to the crowd and says, who are my mother and brothers? Those who do the will of my Father. When his disciples come and say, Jesus, we have left everything to follow you. What mother, father, mother, kids, wives? He says, in my kingdom, when you give up those things for me, you will receive multiple times brothers, kids, mother, father, in my kingdom. See, Jesus redefines what it means to be family in the Gospel of Matthew. So when he gets to the end of the Gospel, you've been left hanging with this question, where are Jesus' kids? And he turns to his disciples and he says, I want you to go and replicate who I am, take my image and remake it amongst the nations. By making disciples, we are redefining the family of God and making children of Jesus and God everywhere we go. That's why John opens his gospel with, it is those not who are born of blood, not who are born of the will of men, but those who are born of the Spirit, born of God. Those are children of God. And that's the lineage of Jesus. See, to take up the Great Commission is not just something you add to your checklist of Christian things to do. This idea of discipleship is our primary task as followers of Jesus. It's not something that's optional at all. And so I want to close with this ancient Jewish blessing as we finish up. I'm going to close up, and then Ben's going to come and talk about some practical ways to apply this. But Jesus lived at a time where there were rabbis and disciples. This was a common thing. If I was a teacher of the law, I would study under a rabbi. That rabbi would teach me everything he knows. And my job as a disciple would be to be exactly like my rabbi. So there was rabbis like Gamaliel who taught Paul. And Paul, as a disciple of Gamaliel, would observe his rabbi as close as he could. He would watch how he cooked dinner, how he ate food, how he washed his hands, how he put on his sandals, how he put on his clothes. And it would be the disciple's job to do everything the exact same way and to learn his interpretation of the law the exact same way so that he could replicate that rabbi when he grew up. And so they had this saying. Jesus did this himself. He called disciples, and they were supposed to replicate him. And they had this saying that they said to disciples as they followed their master. They would say, may you be covered in the dust of your rabbi. May you follow on his heels so closely that the sandals of his shoes kick up dust that covers your head. That is our call. To find what Jesus was doing and replicate it as best we can through the Spirit in our communities, our towns, our cities, our neighborhoods. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, what you came to do is save the world. Save the world from the sin that Adam brought in, from death. And this whole story has been climaxing to you. And as we sit here as your people, your church, your children, you've asked us to take on this idea of making disciples just the way you did. We can't do it as perfectly as you did. We want people to follow us as far as we follow you. And in those places where we don't follow you well, that we learn to grow through your Spirit. I pray that you ignite something within each of us. You motivate and inspire us to rethink how we are living our lives and to take up this call of spreading your kingdom. Amen.
It is an honor to be here with you guys, and I'm so excited to continue this conversation with you. Yes.